Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon and welcome to the Spingola Zone. It is Tuesday, April 8th, 2014. This is Deanna Spingola. The American Free Press sponsors this weekly radio program. Their website is AmericanFreePress.net. I have been a subscriber to the American Free Press and recommend a subscription to that newspaper as well as a subscription to the wonderful historical journal, The Barnes Review, whose website is barnesreview.org, and Barnes is spelled B-A-R-N-E-S. Please visit both websites, support the efforts of the people who report accurate history and contemporary events. My websites are spingola.com and spingolaspeaks.info. We will take calls in the second hour after we open the phone lines at 347-215-7292. Next week, I will be changing the time and day for this program. It will be on from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. on Wednesday. We will be taking questions and comments from the listeners via my email, comment@spingola.com, or from the chat room, spingola.chatingo.com. Our guest today is Dr. Linda Lagemann. That's L-A-G-E-M-A-N-N. She is a commissioner on the Citizens Commission on Human Rights and an associate clinical professor at the University of California at San Francisco and a licensed clinical psychologist who recently closed her practice to devote herself full-time to addressing the very serious issues in the mental health field. Her website is drlagemann.com. Please also visit cchr.org and cchrinp.org. And please watch the film, The Hidden Enemy. It is amazing. Absolutely amazing. Watch it several times. Take notes. Then do research on the notes that you've taken, and it'll just open your mind to what's going on. Dr. Lagemann, thank you so much for joining me again today.
Thank you.
All righty. Fort Hood. Again.
Yeah. You want me to just start in?
Yep.
Okay, well, you know, the recent shooting, the Fort Hood shooting that I think, you know, your listeners are aware of that just happened, where Ivan Lopez killed four people, including himself, and wounded 16 others. And already the media and the, you know, psychiatric, quote, experts that have been brought forward are starting to, you know, try to spin this as caused by his underlying mental illness, and already the calls are coming in for more intervention, more funds for psychiatric drugs and treatment. So I want to, you know, kind of pull back from that because this is, you know, this has happened each time. There's so many of these shootings that we've had and violence that the common denominator are psychiatric drugs. So I don't think anybody disputes that the psychiatric drugs are, every one of the school shootings that I'm aware of, 31 of recent years, all of those where they've released the toxicology reports, the shooter was on psychotropic drugs. And it's not surprising, which we'll get into, of what the effects are of the psychotropic drugs. But so that's clear. But what you end up having happen in the media and with some of the people who have an interest, this is the thing, you know, the conflict of interest here from the psychiatrists and even from the media that gets lots of revenue from the pharmaceutical ads, they start saying, okay, well, yes, they were on psychiatric drugs, but the reason they were on them is because they had a mental illness, and it's the mental illness that is the cause. So, yeah, okay, so that could sound reasonable. But I want to, like, really lay out, and especially because we have the time here, to really lay out why that is a false argument. First, just looking at the military, because this has, you know, been an area and a population that the pharmaceutical industry has really targeted and has increased their revenue substantially by tapping into the budget, you know, the Department of Defense budget and the Veterans Affairs budget. Actually, right now, let's see, the combined budget, the mental health budget for the Department of Defense and the Veterans Administration totals $9 billion a year. So,
oh, my gosh.
I know. Yeah.
$9 billion a year that they get to play around with and give to their friends over at the pharmaceutical industry.
Right.
Holy cow.
So, yeah. So I want to, so that's what I mean in terms of conflict of interest. Like, I mean, I think that's something really to be aware of is who's speaking and what the conflict of interest may be. So, anyway, looking at the military, historically, one could not be in the military if they were on a psychiatric drug. And that makes complete sense. Psychotropic drugs alter your mind. That is what they are mind-altering. Psychotropic, it means turning. You know, tropic means turning. So it turns your mind. So you couldn't be in the military. And historically, the military was known for having an unusually low suicide rate. And people would study this. There actually were different hypotheses of why that was, because it's kind of surprising. They have, you know, grueling training and conditions and the horrors of war, but they had a lower suicide rate than the general population. Then we, you know, move forward. So this is the history. No drugs and lower than normal suicide rate. Then we move forward to when the psychiatric and pharmaceutical industry got a hold and really started really infiltrating the military. And from 2005 to 2011, there was a 682% increase in psychiatric prescription drugs written to the military. 682% increase. That's 30 times faster growth rate than in the general population. So it was a massive influx of psychiatric drugs in the military. And so that started in 2005. The following year, we have what would be expected. The following year, 2006, there is an increase of 30% in violent sex crimes and in domestic violence in military families.
Oh my.
There is a 43% increase in child abuse in domestic families in 2006. This is extreme. This is not only the damage and destruction of the individuals taking the psychotropic drug, but now the destruction of the family, of the military families. When you have, in 2006, an increase of 43% of child abuse. This didn't occur before. So, and then the other thing is the suicides that are very well documented and are a big problem that the military is trying to figure out. The former Secretary, U.S. Secretary of Defense, Leon Panetta, called it an epidemic. There is an epidemic of suicides in veterans and active duty troops. More active duty troops are killed, die by suicide than are killed by the enemy. Then more died by suicide than died in Afghanistan and Iraq. So they're actually right now 22 veterans that kill themselves every day and one active duty soldier that kills himself each day.
And these are people that aren't necessarily involved in warfare. I mean, some of them have never ever seen active warfare. They could be anywhere. They could be stationed anywhere.
Yes, this is true. It's I think it's 85% of the suicides in the military never saw combat.
Okay.
So, because that's another thing that, you know, people's minds do go to when you're trying to fathom something as painful and stark as these numbers. You know, you look for reasons and you look for ways to make it make sense. And the first thing people think is, well, the, you know, combat and seeing your buddies killed is horrific, which it is. And they're thinking that's the explanation for the suicides, but it's not the case because, as I said, 85% of them never saw combat. But psychiatric drugs are rampant in the military now and unregulated, unmonitored. There are troops that are given bags of various psychotropic drugs, like a six-month supply, I think. They're just given a bag of drugs with no supervision, no monitoring, and just told to use them to take the edge off, use them as they see fit. So
wow.
These are incredibly powerful drugs, and you know there's a reason that they didn't you couldn't be in the military in the past taking a psychotropic drug. Just on the very basic of it, it alters your judgment. Your sense of reality, your impulse control, and then you add to that some of the other side effects, like with the antidepressants. So, you know, back to the Ivan Lopez, who, you know, the Fort Hood shooter. You know, he was on Ambien. That has been reported. It has been reported also that he was on other drugs treating depression and anxiety. I have not seen yet that released what he was on exactly, the whole drug cocktail, but antidepressants and anti-anxiety drugs are both categories of drugs that have very dangerous side effects. Well, all of the psychotropic drugs do, but the antidepressants cause anxiety, actually. The antidepressants cause anxiety, cause an emotional numbness, irritability, hostility, mania, which is, you know, like just more of an agitation, and something that's called akathisia, which akathisia is, I've talked to people who've been on these drugs and had it, and they've described it as, it's an agitation and a restlessness that's like under your skin and that you can't get rid of it. Like you can work out, you can go for a run, nothing gets rid of it. It's an inner just crawling under your skin unbearable agitation. Now, that's one of the things that actually drives people to violence, both, you know, to homicide and suicide. And then, you know, the antidepressants also violent and suicide. Now, the anti-anxieties have some similar kinds of side effects, you know, including, you know, the confusion, disorientation, depression, impaired thinking and judgment, irritability, anxiety. So, you know, you combine these things. You take somebody who is struggling. So there are very real struggles, and I don't in any way want to minimize the legitimate, real struggles, mental and emotional, the pain that people go through, and particularly some of our veterans and active duty troops. But these are not mental disorders. There's nothing wrong with the brain. And putting a chemical in the brain, a psychoactive substance in the brain, hampers and disables a person's own abilities to come to terms with what they're already struggling with. So when somebody's overwhelmed and their mind is overwhelmed or overstimulated by something, they need some space, they need some, you know, lack of stimulation, they need sleep, good nutrition, talking to people who understand and are going through something similar. The last thing, the worst thing you could do is drug the person and compromise all of their abilities to cope. All of the psychoactive drugs are they are anesthetizing parts of the brain, the mostly frontal lobe. So what you're doing is you're disabling part of your frontal lobe. So you're impaired thinking then and caring, you know, connection to other people, and your emotions are all shutting down. That is an extremely dangerous and disabling position to be put in when you already might be on edge and struggling with something.
True.
And what we see is this is the very thing that puts people over the edge. So, you know, there have been reports that Ivan Lopez, you know, had lost his mother recently and, you know, been transferred, moved around, so, and that had sought, was being evaluated for PTSD. So he was struggling with something, and that's no doubt. It's very unlikely that that, and there was no history of violence with him, and a month prior when he was evaluated by the psychiatrist there, he didn't show any signs of any violence or anything unusual. So it's really unlikely that he would be driven to do something like this of his own,
right,
you know, without the introduction of the drugs that have those very side effects. That's the nature of the drugs. Those are, you know, the adverse reactions that are caused by the drugs.
It's amazing that the psychiatrists don't recognize this, but yet they don't. In order to prepare for this program, I've been reading Psyched Out, How Psychiatry Sells Mental Illness and Pushes Pills That Kill by Kelly Patricia O'Meara, and I've also read a few other books. And just looking at the Bible, the so-called Bible.
Mm-hmm.
They just make up these diseases, these mental conditions, in order to prescribe something for you. I mean, it's all just made up.
It's so completely true. Do you know, on the weekend, I was at a store and talking to this 20-something girl, and we just got to talking. And she told me she was in graduate school, she's business school, and she has a class right now on marketing. And she said that the professor is using the psychiatric drugs as an example of marketing because it's most effective, because she said she used the same phrase, because they're able to sell drugs for made-up illnesses.
Right.
This is
amazing.
Business school. She's in graduate business school, and this is what they're using as an example in the marketing class. And that is the case. We see this in, and we are bombarded by it in America because of the pharmaceutical lobbyists that in 1997 got Congress to allow direct-to-consumer advertising of psychiatric disorders and psychotropic drugs. So we hear it all the time, and there's in the business, there's a phrase, they call it the you're sick and you didn't know it ads. And,
right,
and we all recognize them. You hear someone says, do you ever experience this? Have you experienced that? You may be suffering from this disorder, and
right,
then there's this drug that will help. It's very insidious, and we've been really bombarded by this for the last 16-plus years. There's some kids who've grown up with this as the norm, psychiatric ad. And it shapes how people view their struggles. When you keep hearing this over and over, hours, I can't remember the numbers now of how many hours of psychiatric drug ads the average American sees per year, but it's hours. It causes people to rethink and recategorize, or not think at all, right? But they start looking at, you know, because you hear the ads and you think, oh yeah, I've experienced that, yeah, and you're thinking, it's like, oh, I didn't know that was a mental disorder. Well, I guess I better get help instead of having a struggle, a life struggle, regular, being human, and talking to somebody or going for a walk, you know, getting out, change of
perspective.
Chocolate, exercise. You know, exercise by study, by scientific study, exercise is the single best intervention treatment for depression. It's exercise. But, you know, when you've been so, you know, shaped by the drug ads, people want the pill. They think that's the answer and that's the easy thing. Like, they don't want to look at what the conditions are in their life that might need changing, you know, their job, relationship, their own, you know, approach to things.
Nutrition or anything.
Nutrition. Yeah, exactly.
The other thing, too, is that regular doctors now prescribe all of these, so it isn't even as that the patient or the person has to go to a psychiatrist to get a drug. They just can mention to, well, I remember when my mother died, I just mentioned to my doctor that my mother just passed away, and she immediately said, oh, do you need something for depression? I said, well, no. I mean, it's a life experience, and you deal with it. But they just immediately offer you something. I think they get some sort of bonuses for the most prescriptions written in a year or something.
Yeah. Actually, they do. And there's a really interesting book you're aware of it, John Brierpen's book, Side Effect
right.
Death.
Right, right.
He was the former head of Eli Lilly in Sweden, and wrote this book. It's kind of a confessional, combination confessional expose, but he just lays it all out of the marketing tactics, the bribery, what they do with the doctors. Now, when you're talking about like primary care doctors, somebody's regular general practitioner, they prescribe over 70%. Of the psychiatric drugs.
Wow.
And how that happens, it's, again, this has been, you know, the psychiatric industry has been really effective in the pharmaceutical industry in their strategies. So primary care doctors have been targeted, and they go to continuing education seminars, and they listen to the experts. So they will have a psychiatrist whose specialty is, you know, psychiatry, come and talk to them and tell them, hey, you know, when you have a patient and they happen to mention that they're feeling down or something, you should prescribe, you know, Prozac, because that really helps in my experience. And what the doctor, the primary care doctor, doesn't know is that psychiatrist was paid by, for example, Eli Lilly to go and give those talks and push the drugs. So a lot of the people prescribing these drugs have been duped. They don't know. And, you know, back to, like, so Eli Lilly, these antidepressants and, you know, the violence and suicides. Prozac, Eli Lilly's own study, their own internal studies that were hidden for many years but are now come to light, Eli Lilly's own studies showed that Prozac increased suicide, and it increased it. And there have actually been some other studies now, another independent study done that went over the same some of the same data, comparing different antidepressants. But there was per 1,000 people in the study. So these are like a controlled clinical study, by the way. So a controlled clinical study. This is the gold standard of causation. When you're trying to see what causes something, you control for all other variables, and that's what the whole clinical control study is, so that when you have the outcome, you know that it was because of factor, you know, A or B. Anyway, in their controlled studies, there was one suicide per 1,000 in the placebo group. So the group that got no drug, one suicide per 1,000, in the between 1 and 2, actually, so I'll put that in there. And then in the other antidepressants, it was doubled. There were 4 suicides. So taking an antidepressant doubled your risk of suicide. And in the Prozac group, there were 12 suicides in just the Prozac specific group. 12 suicides.
Oh my gosh.
So this is, and you know, the FDA knows this. This is part of why you know, there are the warning labels. But so when people, again, when people say, oh, like right now you see in the media, there's no proof that the drugs cause this. And it's like, there's ample proof. There's the drug company's own internal studies and the FDA. So there are black box warnings on all of these antidepressants, all of them. There are black box warnings, the most serious warning you can have, warning about suicide and homicide. Now, federal regulations say that to put a warning label on, there has to be a degree, a reasonable degree of certainty about the causality. So those warning labels are very hard to get, those black box warning labels. And FDA regulations say that there has to be a reasonable degree of certainty about the causality before they will put it on the warning label. So it's already proven. You know, the fact that it's on the warning label, you have black box warning. So it's saying that this has been proven already. It's not a conjecture.
And usually the people that are with the FDA that are looking at this have ties, have connections to the pharmaceutical industry. And so the problem has become so bad that even they have to admit, despite their financial connections to the industry, they have to admit that there's something wrong, because so many of the families that have lost children or spouses or daughters or other family members to suicide because of these drugs, they've had hearings. In fact, didn't they have some hearings back in 2003? And they said, no, we're not going to do anything. But then they recently had more hearings, and so they did have to put the black box label on.
Yeah. Yes, there were more. I don't know which year it was that they put the warning on. But they did, and it's there, and it's known. So when people are, looking for the why, they're not paying attention to, you know, what you were just bringing up, how actually it is hard to get those warnings, because you do have people in the FDA that have pharmaceutical industry ties, and there's kind of a employment back and forth. There are a lot of people that are trying to do good also, and unfortunately the way the regulations are written, the drug companies don't have to tell about their studies. They don't have to report them. And in fact, the way the regulations are written currently, a drug company can test a drug and have it fail in 10 studies and cause, you know, serious adverse reaction, like suicide, let's say. So, like, it can cause suicide. And then they can do one study where it beat the placebo minimally, and that is the only one they have to report. They can cherry pick. They can decide what they're going to report. So they'll report a study saying, oh, it beat placebo. See, we're a good, medication. They do not have to tell that they tried, you know, and they've manipulated the data because 10 other times it failed. All right, and that gets reported saying this is an effective drug. It beat placebo. They do not have to report suicides, and one of the ways that they have concealed that, and violence also, one of the ways they've concealed it is by just calling it a non-effect, like saying, oh, this person didn't benefit from the drug, and it gets categorized as that. It doesn't get categorized as a suicide or violence. It's as a non-effect.
Wow.
So there are all kinds of ways right now that the pharmaceutical industry can conceal and manipulate the data. But despite all of that, there still are black box warnings. And so we know this. We know it causes violence. And Prozac, there was a study recently done. I'm not sure if I, it's not on the tip of my tongue. If I think of it during the broadcast, I'll bring it back up. But it was showing the five drugs that are disproportionately linked to violence. There are five different of the psychotropic drugs that are disproportionately linked to violence, and Prozac was the top one. So we know the violence. We have all these other examples too. You know, the other shootings. You know, the school shootings. Like I said, 31 in recent years that have all been linked to psychiatric drugs.
And they don't. They want to hide this. They want to conceal this somehow, and obviously for reasons.
Mm-hmm.
It's also interesting that Eli Lilly is the one that developed LSD for the CIA in the 1950s.
Oh yeah. Well, that's you know, the history also of some of the drugs, you know, bringing the CIA and just also the history of psychiatry in the military. This is something that's covered in the documentary, the CCHRI documentary that you mentioned and encouraged people to watch, The Hidden Enemy. It's the latest documentary that the Citizens Commission on Human Rights has put out. And people can see that. We have the website, one of them, the cchr.org/vets, you know, for veterans, V-E-T-S.
Right.
So cchr.org/vets. If anybody goes directly to that website, there's a, you know, can right on the website right there, you can watch The Hidden Enemy for free. It's just, you can see it on there. And there are other services and information specifically for veterans. But that documentary certainly addresses all of the current issues in the military and has interviews with over 80 military personnel of all different ranks and experts. But it certainly looks at the problem of today, but the history of psychiatry in the military and the increase in using the military to experiment on with drugs. And there were those experiments, the LSD experiments, on the military, unknown to them when they were being given LSD back in, I think it was it the 70s, 60s or 70s,
yeah.
that was going on. But that
amazing
made it all
stuff.
In the, yeah. You know, they've been effective at this. You know, and right now it's really a critical time because, you know, this tragedy happened, one in a list of many similar tragedies that could have been prevented because they are, you know, caused by the very drugs. This is, you know, the ultimate betrayal when you say you're helping somebody and it's actually causing more destruction. So it could have been prevented. But it's very urgent right now because this is being used, the tragedy is being used to say, oh, we need more mental health treatment and
more drugs.
Week, more drugs. Well, that's what it usually means. That's unfortunately.
Yeah.
And this is also a thing. Because all of the budget and all this money goes to drugs, it doesn't go to real help. There's real help is needed. Again, I'm not minimizing the actual help that's needed in the struggles. And people are not getting help because all that money is being funneled and is being spent, all the billions are being spent on psychiatric drugs. And it's a massive industry, the psychiatric and pharmaceutical industry, and that alliance between psychiatry, pharmaceutical industry, and government in some cases is just powerful force.
Amazing. It is amazing.
It's amazing. Yeah. Doing so much damage. So right now,
and that's just $9 billion a year just for the military. What about all
yes.
the money that is spent? For instance, like the prison population, they also use the prison population to experiment on, and they also use child services. I think a lot of the children who are in child services or protected services are on drugs because it's a group that is vulnerable and terrible.
That's the foster care system is one where that's really abused, and more than half of foster kids are on one or more psychiatric drugs. There's so many abuses, and I mean this is the reason that CCHR exists. CCHR, Citizens Commission on Human Rights, that's its purpose and it exists. It's a nonprofit, non-political, non-religious mental health watchdog, and it is it's looking at and researching and uncovering abuses committed in the mental health field and getting legislation to protect people. So since 1969, that's what the CCHR has been doing, helping to get more than 150 pieces of legislation passed to protect people. But the foster kids, that's a huge area where, because Medicare pays. And this is where you see abuses.
Okay. Wow.
Yeah, it's money, and it's horrible because one of the things, there's been just a huge increase in antipsychotics given to children, and part of that is, again, the Medicare paying, and a couple of billion that is just in antipsychotics for children now. The other thing, Medicare, again, the psychiatric system, when there's a third of all patients, a third of all people that are given electroconvulsive therapy, ECT, shock therapy, where brain damaging electrical currents are shot through the brain. A third of the people given ECT are 65 and older. And
aren't there like 10,000 people a year that die from those?
I don't know the number, but I would not doubt that. It's an extremely primitively destructive, thing. I mean, you can't call it a treatment. It's really just a torture experiment. Yeah. So when we look at, the money trail on this, from age 64 to age 65, there's a 360% increase in the amount of ECT given. Right, because Medicaid kicks in at age 65. So right now the U.S. government pays $5 billion each year on ECT, destructive brain damaging.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. So there's a lot of work for us to do to protect people and get information out there, kind of all across the age spectrum. There are psychiatric abuses that need addressing. And, from the child drugging that has right now birth to one-year-olds as the fastest-growing market of all psychotropic drugs. And it's hard to keep up with the numbers because they keep rising. But currently, one in 70 preschoolers is on a psychiatric drug. It's just the numbers are outrageous. And the kinds of powerful, mind-altering substances that are being put in these children is criminal. And the damage that will be done over time is untold, unknown. But there certainly is plenty of damage that is known right now that's occurring with that. But, so I said there are abuses from, all the way of childhood to elderly. And then right now what we're looking at, the violence that is caused, because this is something that, we've had so many examples of this where it's the link is there and it keeps getting covered up, and we need to demand. I mean, what, you know, when you were encouraging people to watch The Hidden Enemy, I think that's great. I think it would be, once people hear this information, like right now, you know, the listeners all carry a responsibility because they're hearing this and they know this. Now, it's not enough for you to just know this and sit in your home. You have a responsibility now to take action, to try to help and make a change.
Right.
You know, spreading the word, you know, telling your neighbors and friends, anybody who says, "Yo, yeah, my doc says I should start on this drug." It's like, I don't think so. Go to CCHR.org, CCHRINT.org. That's the for international. That CCHRINT.org has the drug database. It's got all FDA warnings and reports. This is very important for somebody to see what's been reported. This is all stuff that's, you know, official reports of these drugs. It's an incredibly comprehensive database that's been put together. It's used by journalists because it's really great. So
yes,
I encourage people
absolutely.
To go there. But the responsibility people have, I mean, the other thing is writing, you know, your representatives, you know, demanding that there be a congressional investigation into psychiatric drugs and violence. How many of these shootings do we need to have? You know, the school shootings, Columbine, the same thing on Zoloft, the Aurora Theater, you know, the Batman shooter,
right.
From the Holmes on
right.
Zoloft. You know, we need to stop this now. We need to act now. And, you know, CCHR, you know, we're calling for congressional action, you know, both an investigation into the link between psychiatric drugs and violence, and then legislation. We've got to stop drugging the military.
Everybody.
Stop drugging everybody, exactly.
There was a petition on the White House petition website in December of 2012 to formally investigate the link between psychopharmaceutical products and violence. And then without explanation, somebody removed it when it had almost the acquired number of signatures. Evidently, the government is deliberately suppressing research into that connection between the drugs and the mass shootings.
Huh, that's very interesting. I did not know that.
Yeah, well, that, I got that off the website. There was an article back
in... On the CCHR website?
Uh-huh, the CCHRINT. Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh.
That was back at in January by Phil Hickey.
Yeah. What's that?
By Phil Hickey, wrote an article about that. And the other thing too is that with the release of the new DSM, that they have added more maladies, more things you can have. I mean, they just make the stuff up. It's just all made up. They have something for everybody, and the insurance companies, because they view this, the DSM, as a scientific document, are now willing to pay insurance, pay for pharmaceutical drugs for people who have insurance.
Right. Yeah, it's really crazy how this is going on because, you know, everything you said is true. It's made up. And it's something that most people, and actually most even in the mental health, you know, quote, I put that in quotes now, mental health field, because I really feel like the field is doing more damage, more harm than good. So I've taken to using quotes now, talking about the mental health field. But people in that field also are not aware of this. I do continuing education seminars for licensed therapists. And when I go over the history and how the DSM is created, this diagnostical and statistical manual that's used, they are uniformly shocked. They had assumed that it was based on science, hard science. they had no idea that this stuff is just made up, voted on. It's not based on science. There are no tests. There's nothing. It's somebody's opinion, somebody who says, oh, you know, there's, we'll call this a disorder. This is actually what happened with many things, you know, with ADHD. Somebody took a bunch of, you know, behaviors that had always been there, you know, ants in the pants and, you know, all of that that had existed forever, and reformulated it and put a name on it, a label on it, calling it attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, and that shaped everything. Once you call something a disorder, you constrict people's thinking and you channel them into medication. You say, oh, this is a disorder. This is a biochemical imbalance. And the same thing with PTSD. So 1980, a psychiatrist defined the very real normal reactions to trauma and defined those as pathological, as a disorder, as a mental disorder, and put the name PTSD. Now, like for military, you know, quote, PTSD has always been known. It's always been there. The war is war is hell.
And sure.
There was shell shock, battle fatigue, different ways that people referred to that. And there's definitely help is needed to adjust and to handle the you know, the consequences of that kind of trauma. But, you know, it is not a mental disorder. It's a normal reaction that any of us would have if we went through those circumstances. And that's something, you know, that I feel very strongly about. I mean, not only just because of what you're saying about these diagnoses being made up, but I feel very strongly about the damage that's done by telling a veteran who's having a normal reaction, by telling them that they're somehow broken, or that they have a mental disorder now. And it's like, that is so destructive. And it's just not true, is the other thing. It's patently not true. They're having a normal reaction. Just like when somebody, a loved one dies and you grieve, and, you know, you're not interested in things so much. Maybe you lose your appetite. Maybe, you know, all of that. That is a normal reaction. And it's not a mental disorder.
Right.
But so many things now, like, you know, the very real problems in concentrating, being a little on edge, you know, coming back from military service or being in service, those are normal, and those things have been called a disorder, and then people get funneled. I think it's the number is to 80-something percent of military folks or veterans that are labeled as PTSD are then put on a psychiatric drug.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, and once somebody is, and that's the most common, that's the most popular diagnosis now in the military, PTSD. Once somebody's put on a psychiatric drug, it doesn't stop with one, because, of course, the person gets worse. You put them on a mind-altering psychotropic drug, they get worse. Then they get put on a second drug because now they have some other symptoms, and then they get put on a third drug, and there are it just keeps climbing. And
sure.
I don't know, again, if that's something that, you know, people realize, that it's actually gotten kind of unusual for somebody to just be on one drug,
right?
Because the problems it creates.
And then you also have the American Psychiatric Association, which promotes all of this. They have quite an interesting connection to the government and to the pharmaceutical industry, and they all feed off of each other, correct?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. The American Psychiatric Association has, they make... I think most of their budget comes from sales of the DSM. They get millions of dollars in sales of the DSM. So they have an interest in, you know, coming out with new ones periodically.
Oh,
one,
okay.
Just on the level of book sales, that's a very, very big part of their budget, their income, is the book sales. Then, you know, with each, it enriches the whole system, the psychiatric and pharmaceutical system, because with very minor changes in language even, you can broaden the diagnostic criteria for something and include many more people that before you changed the wording would have been normal, but now are not normal. And that right. is what's happened in the most recent version. I mean, that's what happens with each version, but most recently that happened in a big way with the ADHD diagnosis that was broadened, depression was broadened. You know, I mentioned earlier somebody grieving. Well, it used to be in the prior version of the diagnostic manual, it used to be that if a loved one had died within the, you know, the 2 month period before you're talking about, so like within 2 months, if you had had a loved one died, you could not be diagnosed as majorly depressed because it was recognized that you're grieving. So
sure.
those symptoms, you know, like loss of appetite or loss of interest in, you know, usual fun activities, all that, was recognized that that's grief. Well, the new edition of the DSM got rid of that, what was called before the bereavement exclusion, that you couldn't be diagnosed depressed if you were grieving. That they eliminated that. So now, if you had a spouse, a friend, a child die, and you are grieving, you now will be diagnosed as having major depression. And once that occurs, this is, you know, you then get put on an antidepressant.
Which and so many of them are very addictive. Once you're on them, you can hardly get off of them.
That's right, and they are. And that's something, you know, that the antidepressants do a couple things. One, you know, that's relating to, you know, this recent shooting. They cause violence. And, you know, there are 22 international drug regulatory warnings about these drugs causing mania, hostility, violence, and even homicidal ideation. So let's see, what year is it? There's, between 2004 and 2012, there's the FDA has this MedWatch system on psychiatric drugs that people can report adverse
right.
reactions. So from 2004 to 2012, there were 14,773 reports, I'm looking at it right now, of psychiatric drugs causing violent side effects, including 1,531 cases of homicidal ideation or homicide, and then others, you know, like of mania, aggression. But I want to make a note here for people to know that the FDA itself has estimated that only less than 1% of all adverse reactions ever get reported to them.
Oh, my gosh.
So we're looking at the tip of the iceberg, because it's not like every time somebody gets homicidal or something that they, you know, somebody calls the FDA or reports it on their MedWatch system. So think about that. How few times that probably gets reported. And even with that, there were 14,000. I'm just looking at the homicidal ideation or actual homicides. 14,773 reports of that as to the FDA. So that's, you know.
Now,
so
that
know
is FDA.gov.
That's, you know what, I don't know what there is. It's the FDA MedWatch system. I don't know what the,
okay.
So they cause violence. Now, the other thing the antidepressants do is they cause chronic depression. And that may be surprising to people, but here's what happens. You take an antidepressant, these ones that are now what everybody's using, the SSRIs, it stands for serotonin selective reuptake inhibitor. What it does, I'm just going to break it down, it artificially increases the amount of serotonin in the brain. Reuptake is like where it gets reabsorbed. It prevents the reuptake, so it doesn't let it get reabsorbed. So one cell releases serotonin and then the receptor that's there to receive it would normally absorb it, and it would kind of fire once and then recirculate in the system. But now it just keeps firing. It does not reabsorb. It doesn't reuptake. So the amount of serotonin you were creating, all of a sudden it seems like you have much more because it's not reabsorbing. It just keeps firing and on the receptor. Okay, so the brain, that the normal brain that did not have the chemical imbalance before taking the drug, that brain recognizes and says, we have more serotonin than is normal here. We need to adjust. So the brain is going to compensate. And what it does two things. It shuts down, it starts, it decreases the amount of serotonin it was producing to compensate for the artificially increased level. So it decreases production of serotonin. And two, it shuts down some of those receptors. It starts to, like atrophy, it closes down some of the receptor sites. So it's trying to rebalance because of this intrusion into it that's, you know, messing up its natural chemistry. So now when the person stops taking the antidepressant, now they get depressed because now their chemistry's been changed, and it takes quite a while to have the brain readjust back. But that's why people get depressed going off it. And what typically happens is they are told, oh, you are just one of those people, you have a genetic issue, you have a chemical imbalance, you're just one of those people who has to stay on the antidepressant for the rest of your life and be, you know, a lifelong customer for the pharmaceutical industry, ka-ching. Yeah, and the people's lives get ruined and they get disabled by this. Now, all of this with it being not valid science. You know, people are being given these powerful drugs, lives ruined, disability created, when even the director of the National Institute of Mental Health, Thomas Insel, the director of National Institute of Mental Health, our highest government, you know, mental health body, said that the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual that the American Psychiatric Association puts out lacks validity. And furthermore, the NIMH made a statement last year that they will no longer fund any research because of it, because it lacks validity. They won't fund any research that's based on DSM diagnoses. That's very damning. That's, you know, our highest mental health body saying that this doesn't have validity. But it's used every day to label and drug people. And it's the most destructive thing in our culture right now.
Right. Now, they did have a reversal. The American Psychiatric Association reversed their views on homosexuality because it used to be considered a mental disorder. And then that particular lobby became so big that they went after them. And this was early in the 1950s, I think. And so then they grouped homosexuality under the diagnosis of sexual deviation. And then in the DSM-2, in 1968, they said that homosexuality was elevated and received its own diagnosis, but they said it was sexual deviations. And then it became now it has gone all the way from that up to the DSM-4, which does not even mention homosexuality, but rather now has a category that says gender identity disorder.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, I mean, they do reversals because of the, you know, the gay lesbian movement, and it was so big and they had such a voice. That they forced the American Psychiatric Association to reconsider.
Right. Well, that's a great example of the fact that, you know, they couldn't do any of that if there were science involved. So that's a perfect example of the lack of science. So it just depends on what the opinion is at the time of the, you know, the culture or, you know, whoever's got the, you know, the dominant lobby. But, you know, can you imagine if medical diagnoses worked like that, that, you know, diabetes or, you know,
or cancer or something.
Yeah, that you say we're going to vote on it, you know, who says yes, who says no. 1 year cancer is a disease, the next year it's not. You know, diabetes, you know, these things have, they have science behind them. If
sure.
I can't go into my doctor and say, I have diabetes, give me insulin. He's going to say, well, let me test your blood, you know, your insulin, your blood sugar level. And he could tell me, here's what your blood sugar is, here's what's the normal range, you have diabetes, here's the insulin. You can go in to a psychiatrist and say, you know, I got ADHD, I think, and, he's, and you will come out with a stimulant, a prescription
right.
for a stimulant,
right.
most likely. And children that are brought to psychiatrists, nine out of 10 children that are brought to a psychiatrist leave with a prescription for a psychiatric drug. Nine out of 10. Yes, that's right.
And what does
yeah.
it do to these young brains? These
well,
young minds? I mean, it's just...
Well, it does a lot of things, and that we know about, you know, because, as I said before, with these drugs, it's getting unusual for somebody to just be on one. But anyway, these the ADHD drugs and what are also commonly given now with them are some are atypical antipsychotics,
right.
which we'll come back to. Were you going to ask something about that? Atypical antipsychotics. I'll come back to that, but. Those they shrink brain tissue. So we're giving these to children. The ADHD drugs, one, they stunt growth. The stimulants. These are amphetamines. They're Schedule II controlled substances. They're in the same category as morphine and cocaine. So we're you know giving these to little kids, getting them addicted, which is the case. They are addicted to the amphetamines, the stimulant drugs. Which then, you know, plays out predictably when they get to high school and college where these prescription drugs now, that they're amphetamines, are, you know, sold and traded, and there's a high abuse rate of the ADHD drugs on college campuses now, you know, created by this whole industry of getting kids. This is the pharmaceutical marketing. You know, you want customers for life, so, you know, the antidepressants create chronic depression. So you got a lifelong customer. The ADHD drugs are addictive, highly addictive. So you create lifelong customer there. But we know those things. We know that it shrinks brain tissue. We know that it stunts growth. We know that causes, you know, a lot of things: aggression, weight loss, which is a real problem in some of these kids where they have severe weight loss. But also in depression, I think I mentioned, yeah, insomnia, increased irritability. But it can also cause seizures, psychosis, and suicidal thoughts. So all of these, all of the ADHD drugs, every one of them, again, just like the antidepressants, has on the warning label to watch for suicidality. For, you know, parents giving it to kids, they are supposed to monitor the child for suicidality. Now, that's kind of hard to monitor. And,
right.
you know, and I think people need to take these drug warning labels very seriously. And I think in our culture, we're used to kind of ignoring them and thinking it's just a bunch of legalese. But it's not. I mean, these were hard won, you know, getting these on there. And they come from actual experiences, and only a fraction of them have been reported. But somebody, you know, a parent and an individual needs to look at that warning label, read each adverse reaction possible, pause on it, and think, are you willing to have that happen to you or to your child? And, you know, take them seriously. They're not fluff. These are not things to be ignored. You know, it took a lot of work for CCHR and other like-minded groups fighting to get these on there, these known adverse reactions. So right. It's just crazy to be giving a kid a drug that might make him kill himself because he's not sitting still in school. No, but I think people are not aware. They are not aware, and most people don't read the drug warning labels. They listen to the doctor who is not informing them about, and this is why there isn't informed consent, and that's another thing that CCHR fights for, is true informed consent so that people can think with the information and they can decide for themselves.
Right.
But there's not, people are told, when I had my practice going, I closed my practice, but when I had my practice, I had parents come in distress, telling me their child was just diagnosed with ADHD and they had to start them on the drug, and they would tell me what the psychiatrist had told them. And a number of times, the same things came up. They were told that they needed to put the kid on the drug or they would not do well in school, they're not going to go to college, they're not going to, their life will be ruined because, they have ADHD. They were also told, completely erroneously, they were told that if they didn't treat the ADHD now, their child was more likely to become a drug addict later. This was a common thing I heard. And it's actually the data, the facts, are the opposite. And common sense would tell you it's the opposite. Common sense would tell you, what do you think is going to happen if you take a child and you get him addicted to amphetamines? Well, he's more likely to use them, continue to use them. Actually, the girl I mentioned earlier in the who's in graduate business school studying marketing, and she talked about how the professors... Yeah. Well, she told me also, she said she's from the ADHD generation, and she said she has friends that have been on ADHD drugs for 10 years, and they can't get off.
Really?
It's very hard to get off of these drugs when you're addicted. Well, it's amphetamine addiction. So this is what we're doing. When you ask what are the effects on the kids, there's so many layers of adverse effects and destruction from these drugs. It's quite concerning of what's the generation going to look like that grows up. These babies and children that are on these drugs now, I can't imagine, but we have to stop this now. It's, it's so destructive.
Now, I had a friend that was on Prozac for 6 years. And she tried to get off. She cut down. She cut back. But then after she got off, she was okay for a while. And then she became very manic. She lost a lot of weight. She just kind of developed some strange characteristics. Then her family. Then she ended up in the psych ward. They put her on Abilify, and she's just not even herself. She's kind of dropped out of our circle of friends. It's terrible.
That's horrible. That's really horrible. That's, this is a life end that was, really, really damaged by psychiatric drugs. Yeah. The antidepressants, depression... Prior to the introduction of antidepressants, in the market, before antidepressants were on the scene, depression was known to be something that could be an episode and would resolve by itself. And the National Institute of Mental Health had different statements about it. It was considered the easiest, or the best prognosis, mental disorder, because it was recognized that people got better with or without treatment. They got better without therapy even. So depression is something, the natural course of depression, it's something that can occur to anybody in the course of their lifetime for whatever reasons and circumstances in life, but it gets better by itself even if you do nothing. Okay. Then antidepressants came on the scene, and the hope was that they might shorten the duration of the depression, you know, the episode. And this was, again, I'm talking like in the psychiatric journals, the National Institute of Mental Health, the head of the depression division of the National Institute of Mental Health said that depression will get better with or without treatment on its own, but the antidepressants might shorten the duration of the episode. It's like, okay. So then you start seeing in the journals, the psychiatric journals, some articles about relapse. So once they introduce the antidepressants, you start getting some journal articles saying, huh, this seems to be causing a relapse. And this is like in the 70s where this is happening. And there's more and more talking about patients being put on it, and it did actually shorten the duration. So people got better quickly, and then got them off of the antidepressant, and then they got depressed again, and which did not used to happen. And so the 70s, 80s, 90s, you see more and more articles. I've got a lot of references on this. But more and more articles where people are talking about that there's a rapid clinical deterioration in the patients when they're taken off of the antidepressant, that they're even saying that it's causing, they're calling it chronification, but, you know, chronic depression. And what happens is then, by the time we get to the, you know, 2000, the year 2000, the journal article starts changing, and they start recognizing that there's relapse and blaming it on the prior condition, the depression, instead of they forget the history, what was already known, that it would get better by itself, and but then they start saying, oh, you know what, depression is actually a chronic illness and it requires continual medication. This is what starts happening in the 2000s, and that's where we are now. And people who are not in the field or haven't looked at the history in the psychiatric journals have been brought up to believe and have been told in ads and have been told by psychiatrists that depression is a chronic illness and that there are just some people who are depressed and it's genetic and it's, you know, all of this. But that's created by the drug. We do have that situation now for the reasons I was describing before, how the brain tries to adjust to the intrusion of this drug. You can't actually, there's a blood-brain barrier, and you can't put serotonin in the brain. The brain will not let that happen. It's a protective mechanism. And what the drug developers did to get around that is, because you can't put serotonin in the brain, it won't let you do that because it doesn't want that imbalance. But how they got around it was the serotonin selective reuptake inhibitor by making it not reabsorb, blocking the reabsorption to artificially increase the level. You know, but that unbalances the brain. And it's really tragic, the example you were talking about, the friend, because that's that kind of spiral. It's like, think, you know, if once you start on the psychiatric drug route, it's a spiral where it causes imbalances and problems and leads to another thing, and, you know, your friend ends up in a psychiatric hospital, which is the worst. You know, there's a book that I just want the readers to have because, you know, we're talking about all of the scary destruction caused by these drugs, which is all valid and important information for people to have. But I don't want anybody to just immediately throw out their drugs and then have the withdrawal that happens, because this needs to be done with medical advice. And there's a great book by Dr. Peter Bregin, Bregin, and it's called Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, and the subtitle is, I think it's a guide for physicians, patients, families, that kind of thing. But it's an important resource of how one would go off of the psychiatric drugs, because the withdrawal phase is also very dangerous. And actually, Glaxo Smith Kline had to pay out it was over $1 billion because they concealed the what they knew as the violence caused by the withdrawal of the I think it was Paxil, but they hid this for years, and then the Department of Justice, caught up with them, and they were sued, and criminal and civil paid penalties out. But they, they hid. Let's find that because they hid this information. It was Paxil. So for years, they hid their own internal studies that showed severe withdrawal because you do get addicted, to the body, your brain compensates. Anyway, severe withdrawal with suicidal and homicidal ideation. So they paid out in a class action lawsuit $1.1 billion, which, by the way, for a drug company, that is nothing. These are not deterrents.
That's nothing.
Not deterrents. They spend $4.2 billion annually on marketing their drugs. So this is nothing. But anyway, the FDA then required them to put the warning label on about the violence and suicidal and violent and homicidal thoughts that happen with withdrawal from the drug. So it's great that there's a warning label. And because all these drug warning labels are, it's very important that they be there. It gives the public a fighting chance. But I'm telling you, I don't understand how these things are not withdrawn from the market.
Absolutely.
You have all of these warning labels because of scientific proof that they cause violence, suicidality, homicidality, all this stuff, and they just put it on a warning label, but they still sell it, and it's still given to children, and it's still given to people who are traumatized and on the edge,
right.
And it pushes them over the edge.
And there's so many children's suicides.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I mean,
there are.
So many.
Yeah. Well, and there's so many children drugged now. There's more than 1 million children under 5 years old on psychiatric drugs now in America. Yeah.
Wow. Now, one of the sites that you mentioned before was the SSRI Stories, and that's SSRIStories.org, where you can visit that website and look at some of the stories there. I mean, it's just amazing, and we never hear about it in the media.
No, because all of that marketing money, I think that's one of the big reasons we don't hear about it, is the marketing money. It's, that's big, the big dollars that go into all those TV commercials, print ads, so we're not hearing about it. Very important, though.
Okay, so you said 1 million children under the age of 5?
Yeah, on a psychotropic drug now. So these, there's, like I said, the damage is being done kind of across the board. With the violence that's created, this is something that I would like, people to think about, take action, write their representatives. I started to mention before there was a bill introduced just last week on the Hill in the House. It was introduced in the House. It's H.R. 4234, and it's called Ensuring Veterans Resiliency Act. It was just introduced last week. And it is calling for an increase in psychiatrists to address a glaring shortage of psychiatrists in the VA. It's very unfortunate, and it was a group of a group of people from the American Psychiatric Association and veterans, actually, went to Capitol Hill pleading for more mental health services to stop the suicides.
Oh, now, gosh, it's only going to increase them.
Right, and I think that's the thing, is that, you know, with they don't have the information. I think if those veterans, and even some of those psychiatrists, because some of them are duped also, some of them are, you know, very much bought by the pharmaceutical industry, and they know very well what they're doing. That's the thing. You know, you've got your percentage of people that are just evil, and they're there. There's that small percentage that is evil, that is really kind of controlling and pulling the strings. And then you have a whole subset of people that are carrying it out that are duped. And that's where, you know, everybody speaking out and getting correct information, getting all of the facts to people makes a difference. Because those good people that are just misinformed, once they see truth, they recognize it. And that will turn things, you know.
Sure.
It's just getting the information to them. But yeah, this bill right now is just horrible. It's like, it's, oh my gosh, you know, it's the last thing needed. And I don't understand. Well, I do. I mean, I think there's so much distraction that happens in the media and that takes away from attention to the psychiatric drugs. You know, distraction by focusing on a gun control issue. That happens whenever there's one of these shootings or a school shooting.
Sure.
That's not the issue. You know,
no,
you're looking
at
these psychiatric drugs, but you get a distraction of like, okay, so let's stir up a gun control issue. Or you say, oh, these poor people don't have enough mental health services. We're failing them. We need to fund more mental health services and get, you know, not let them fall through the cracks. And it's like, that is not what's happening. These people were in the system. That's the problem.
Right.
Just if we go back to what I was saying at the beginning about historically the military, you know, low on violence, low on suicides, lower than normal on suicides. What's the change? Huge influx of psychiatric drugs. That's the change. The nature of war hasn't changed. You know, it's the huge influx of psychiatric drugs.
Sure.
So, you know, to have this bill, it's, you know, and it is gaining co-sponsors every day because a tragedy happened. People want to respond to it. They don't have the correct information, and they think, oh, yeah, we need psychiatrists or the experts. We need more psychiatrists to help with this. And they don't step back and say, you know what, let's, instead of asking the why, like with Ivan Lopez and this recent Fort Hood shooting, instead of wondering why, was it the altercation he had with somebody earlier on the base? Was it that he was only given a 1 or 2 day leave, you know, when his mother died? Instead of the why, all somebody has to do is look at the drug warning label, and it will give you the answer right there. Just right there in the black box warning, causes, you know, suicidal and homicidal ideation. That's the why. That's the answer.
Right.
And we need to take action and do something about it.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I'm just reading this article that was posted about this. And the defense, let's see, who is it? Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel. Yeah. He ordered a series of security changes at military installations, including more rigorous screening of personnel and the creation of an analysis center to examine insider threats. So what's that going to look like? As you say, it's going to be more doctors, more psychiatrists, more medications. They will devote more of the budget, more than $9 million a year to psychiatric drugs. And they're just kind of playing into the hands of the people that have created the problem to begin with.
That is totally well put. That's exactly right. And it's... you know, and it will happen unless we, you know, enough people wise up, wake up, you know, just like in our culture overall. I mean, the influence, the psychiatric influence is really unprecedented. And it's all happened kind of gradually and without us paying attention. We've been asleep, and, you know, there's psychiatric influence in the school systems with the screening, you know, mental health screening tests that basically funnel people to psychiatric treatment for, you know,
exactly.
Drugs.
Yes, and you have the school psychologists now are in the screening. I'm not sure what the screening involves, but they're going to find people. They're going to find victims to put on drugs because they want patients. They want long-time, lifetime patients.
Yeah, well, some of these screenings, I mean, what they involve, like a famous one that was across the country, it's been shut down. Its headquarters is shut down. It's a teen screen. But I don't know how many schools might still be using it. It's just they are not promoting it anymore. As far as I understand, I think I'm correct on that, that they are no longer, they don't have a headquarters, and so they're not promoting it. But schools that were using it may still be using it. But teen screen, as with the others of this kind of mental health screening in the schools, they are written by psychiatrists, funded by the pharmaceutical industry, and the screening tests are, you know, like little 10-minute questionnaires that most people are going to answer yes to the questions, you know? So
sure.
A kid gets asked, oh, do you ever feel left out by your friends or something? You know, you ask any school kid that, and they're going to say yes. And what happens is then they get flagged as depressed and potentially suicidal. And because, you know, once you have a suicide in a school, then that gets exploited. And somebody says, oh, we need mental health screening. This is a tragedy. We don't want, you know, we don't want to miss any kids that need help. But the maker of the teen screen, the psychiatrist who wrote that questionnaire, he admitted that 84%, there was an 84% false positive, you know. So it was written to get people, you know, have people answer yes, and then they got referred for mental health treatment. Now, screening things are completely a marketing tool. These are absolutely pharmaceutical industry driven, all of these. And all the screenings, you know, people Google something, go online and see a questionnaire, you know, do you have anxiety, do you have depression, do you have ADHD, all of those screening things, those are written by psychiatrists or written directly by the pharmaceutical industry. So they're not a public service. The Affordable Care Act, unfortunately, the Affordable Care Act has 30 provisions, at least 30 provisions in it for mental health, you know, provisions. And,
really?
Yeah. And I know one of those, you know, I skimmed through the, you know, summary of those mental health provisions. One of them is a screening for women who've just given birth to screen for postpartum depression.
Mm-hmm.
Now, again, this kind of thing happens because there will be some tragedy that gets reported. Of, you know, like, you know, a woman who kills her kids.
Like Andrea Yates or somebody.
Mm-hmm. Andrea Yates, yes. And then that gets, some bill gets written to, on the surface, seems like a service. It's like, oh, let's try to prevent this. But is really, it's just a pharmaceutical marketing. And it's, you know, they are extremely effective.
They are
just really extremely effective that they've gotten the hold in this country that they have in our educational system with different screenings, mental health screenings in the schools, that parents should definitely talk to their school district, the principal, the board of education in their area, and say they don't want that and that they refuse permission to have their kids screened. These are just funnels to pharmaceutical drugs.
Right.
Our court system, you know, the psychiatry and the court system with that diagnostic and statistical manual that is not valid and is known to not be valid and is not based on any science, but that's used in the court system all the time to decide who gets custody, to, you know, to decide who's going to jail, who's, you know, criminal or who's, you know, not guilty by reason of insanity or whatever things. You know, it's and it's in our military. You know, the the psychiatric system is has really gotten in the military. And, you know, the Hidden Enemy, that documentary, is just a well-documented account of this. And I think you can trace it and see the use of psychiatry in the military. You know, one of the things, too, talking about the violence, the psychiatrists in militaries, not just in this country, but in other countries, psychiatrists working in military know that these drugs cause violence and have actually used them in for this purpose. You know, like kamikazes were on drugs to get them to be exactly these things, aggressive, disconnect from reality so that they're not thinking of consequences, that they're going to die, let's say, you know, just increase the aggression and lack of connection with reality are two things, and the numbing that can go. So various of these drugs have been used exactly to cause this kind of killing machine. Somebody who's a little disconnected, numb, and increased aggression, hostility, and violence.
Wow.
So it's not, so again, like this has been used for that purpose. So then for people who then turn around on the other side, when it happens, you know, outside of, you know, the conditions they were wanting to use it for and say, oh, this doesn't cause it. No, there's no link between that. It's so so well documented.
Such a lie.
It was even used by psychiatrists in military settings for that very purpose.
Right.
So, yeah.
I was looking at a film over the weekend. Let's see the name of it. The Truth About Psychiatry by the CCHR. Fabulous video, and in it they were talking about the, let's see, let me just look at my notes here. I took a bunch of notes. Psychiatric health care is big business. Insurance companies pay out $69 billion every year for psychiatric services, doubling the cost of medical insurance premiums. So we all wonder why the premiums have gone up. Because of the psychiatric services that insurance companies have to pay out.
Yeah. Isn't that something? And what's also, you know, just kind of mind-boggling is all of this, all of that money that you just mentioned that's paid out for psychiatric services, all of this power that the psychiatric and pharmaceutical industry has with not a single cure. No cure.
Exactly.
No real help. And lots and lots of documented disability, death, destruction, ruined lives.
And no cures.
No cure. What other industry could get away with that? Where there's
exactly
no cure, and in fact you give one drug and it makes the person worse, and their failure is turned into profit because they say, oh, you need a second drug. Now I'll sell you two drugs.
Right.
It didn't work. Now I'm going to sell it to you for the rest of your life. It's like every failure and
more profit.
Destruction is their profit. I can't think of another industry that gets away with that. And it's because, like, this people take this that they're experts and don't realize there's no science. They're not experts. This is not based on science. They don't know what the hell they're doing.
Exactly.
You know?
It's by consensus, an opinion.
Right.
Okay, we have somebody with a question here.
Sure.
Okay, go ahead.
Did somebody have a question?
Did somebody have a question, Dave?
I can hear myself talk.
Deanna, can you hear me?
Yes.
I did not have a question. I was monitoring the show, fascinated by the topic, but for some reason the system added me to your queue.
Oh, okay. Well, you're in good company.
Hi.
Okay,
this is
hi.
This is John Riverside, California.
Okay. Well, great.
All right.
Glad to hear from you.
Wonderful topic. I'm just
All
fascinated.
Righty.
Having a hard time getting my work done because I keep listening to the show.
Oh, well, we don't want you getting in trouble, but
right.
Thanks for
Bye-bye.
Listening. Okay. Okay, psychiatrists are paid according to this, according to the film, are paid $23 billion a year to rehabilitate American prisons. In 1965, taxpayers spent $5 billion with a 50% recidivism rate. In 1975, it was $10 billion, and they had a 54% rate. In other words, a person would go back to prison. In 1995, they spent $18 billion with a 62% rate of people going back to prison. In 2005, they were spending $23 billion, and 67% of the people that they treated with drugs were back in prison within 3 years. So what does that tell you? Same thing. No cures.
I mean, this is, no cures. I mean, drugs never rehabilitated anybody, and drugs never taught anybody anything. So back to, you know, like, there are real problems and struggles that people have, but a drug does not address the problem, because, you know, we can get into all the science that disproves this, you know, marketing line about a chemical imbalance, because there just isn't one. It's a complete fabrication. There is no such thing as chemical imbalance, unless you introduce drugs and you actually create one. But so there's not a chemical imbalance. So a chemical is not fixing anything. It's actually causing problems. But you have so. The drugs never taught anybody anything. It does not address whatever is the actual cause of somebody's struggle, their either mental or emotional struggle. And once you start drugging a person and they think that's going to help them, there's no longer attention given to what is needed, looking at their, you know, one, medical issues is the very first thing.
Sure.
You know, a real, actual medical eval to see, you know, some of these you know, veterans have traumatic brain injury, and those the symptoms of traumatic brain injury, you know, difficulty concentrating, anger, some of those symptoms look like also what's labeled as PTSD. And, you know, in these 10-minute psychiatric evals, they're just told, oh, yeah, PTSD, you know, join the club, put on the drugs, and they're not actually treated, and that makes it worse if they have traumatic brain injury, you know, from a concussive blast or something. But the same thing, you know, with children that have sports injuries and concussions and then are diagnosed as ADHD. So a medical exam, you've got to first do that. Then you've got to look at diet, you know, nutrition. So many issues around nutrition and, you know, iron deficiency. A study in France, 2004, was published, showed 84% of the kids that were diagnosed with ADHD were iron deficient, compared to the non-ADHD kids, where it was only 18% had iron deficiency. B vitamins, so lots of nutritional things. Sleep deprivation can cause all kinds of symptoms, including ADHD symptoms in children who have, you know, irregular sleep schedules. You know, and then there's just looking at, you know, life, like the things that somebody needs to take responsibility for and handle in their life, you know, whether it's their work situation, their, you know, home life, themselves, but, you know, needing to have more purpose, needing to exercise, needing to, you know, have some, like, a purpose, something where they're contributing and engaged, all kinds of things, but those
you
help people.
Getting back to the screening, from the film, the same film put out by the CCHR, it's called The Truth About Psychiatry, and you can find it online, and it says, in the educational field, during the last 40-plus years, money doled out to psychiatrists to improve literacy in our schools. In 1965, $1 billion was spent, and the literacy rate was 97%. Okay, in 1975, the government was spending $7 billion to the psychiatrist to improve literacy, and the literacy rate was down to 90. In 1985, they were spending $14 billion, and the literacy rate had fallen to 83%. In 1995, they were spending $21 billion, and the rate of literacy was down to 74%. In 2005, they were spending $28 billion. The literacy rate was down to, would you believe, 69%.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God, that's horrible. Yeah.
Yeah.
This is data I didn't know. This is another example, again, of, you know, psychiatry in the school system and the destruction. I mean, the
influence
that they have.
Yeah.
And like that, you're just laying it out. It's completely clear with the data on, you know, the amount spent on the, you know, psychiatry in there, and then the literacy rate. And that's, again, where their failure, instead of somebody saying, oh, let's look at this, made it worse. Okay, stop, no more, you know, no more psychiatry in the school system. They say, oh, we need to give you more. We need to give you more. Give you more. And it makes it worse and worse and worse. Same thing in, you know, the other, like, kind of the in the military. More and more suicides, you know, kept climbing and climbing and climbing.
And what about, from the same film, there have been more deaths in government psychiatric hospitals from 1965 to 2005 than in all of the U.S. wars from 1776 to 2005. Yeah. 738,000 people died in all the wars, but in just 40 years in government psychiatric hospitals, 1.1 million people died.
Yeah. Yeah, that is, that's a tragedy, and that's one of the reasons that CCHR was formed and exists.
Right.
Because, you know, that's the ultimate betrayal and abuse, human rights abuse and destruction.
And you were talking about electroshock. And the film said, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt, but the film said that psychiatrists electroshocked 2 million people. They do 2 million people a year, killing 10,000 yearly, while raking in $5 billion a year from electroshock, ECT. And this electroshock cost $12 as far as electricity per treatment.
Right. Right. Yeah, it's right. Money and destruction. You know, psychiatrists are statistically, psychiatrists have a higher depression rate than, you know, in the average population. And they're one of the groups, I don't know what it is currently. At one point, psychiatrists had the highest suicide rate. I don't know what it is right now, so I don't want to quote that, the current one. But let's just say they have a high depression and a high suicide rate, psychiatrists. There's not a single psychiatrist, for them giving the ECT and saying, oh, this is good for depression, there is not a single psychiatrist who would subject themselves to ECT.
Wow.
It completely destroys brain tissue. You know, people often ask, well, do you think these psychiatrists will take the drugs? And it's like, actually, the psychiatrists do take some of these drugs. They actually take a lot of the drugs. I don't know the numbers on that. I talked to one person who told me it was around 50% that takes psychiatric drugs. But you ask a psychiatrist, would they do ECT? Would they, you know, would they take that treatment if it's so beneficial for depression? You know, it's like, no, they're not going to do that. It's a brutal, primitive, brain destructive, you know, destroying
I mean, it's like saying, okay,
torture.
Why don't you stick your finger in the outlet? I mean, nobody would do that in their right mind.
No. And this is, you know, like, I don't know, you know, volts of electricity being shot through your brain. So, yeah, but, you know, you're bringing up the money, and this is the thing, $5 billion a year on ECT treatments that are coming, you know, from, this is also taxpayer dollars being used for this, and it's just destroying people. Like, our one that it occurs is crime enough, and then we're being we're paying for this.
Exactly.
And the same thing with all the drugging in the military. It's like, it's ruining people. It's ruining families. And it's they've tapped into the taxpayer dollars. It's a terrible alliance that's going on right now that, you know, needs addressing.
Sure.
Yeah.
Oh, goodness, 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 goodness.
Yeah. Yeah, the, you know, the... all of the known destruction, like, you know, again, the drugs and the known violence and suicide and homicidality and all of this that we know about and that's on the warning labels, you can't imagine another, like, a product being sold, like a car. Like, let's say there's a car, and even if there were two incidents across the country of some car bursting into flames, you know, while it was driving, it would be recalled.
Sure, of course.
You wouldn't be able to buy that car. You would not be able to buy that car with a little warning, you know, insert telling you that, hey, you know, this car might burst into flames while you're driving it. So we have some protections, some consumer protections, you know, like that. Like, if there was a car like that, it would be recalled, taken off the market. But all of these drugs, because of the influence that the psychiatric and pharmaceutical industry have with the government, all of these drugs, with all of the reports, all of the examples, all of the studies, even the drug company studies, all of the known destruction, and they're still on the market. We just
exactly.
get a warning label. Hey, your child,
sure.
you know, give them this for ADHD to help them study, and, you know, watch them. They might kill themselves.
Right.
It's you know, those ADHD drugs, I think it shows also in the literacy statistics you were giving there. They shut a kid up.
It's mind destructive.
They do, yeah, it is. So all the psychotropic drugs, in one way or another, what they do is they dampen frontal lobe functioning. So they are stopping certain functioning. But those kids actually, the largest study that was done in Quebec with... I think it was 4,000 kids. Yeah, 4,000 kids over 11 years. They actually performed worse. They were surprised. They thought that they were going to see better outcomes, you know, in terms of graduation rates. And the kids performed worse. So it shuts them up. It drugs them. But again, drugs don't ever solve anything. They don't teach anybody anything. Even if a kid is all hyper and not sitting still and not listening to the teacher. That's, you know, it's a behavioral issue, and kids get control of themselves over time.
Sure.
But the drug isn't teaching them anything. It's just getting them addicted to a drug.
Sure. Now, the U.S. government funded the Institutes of National Health for the Conference of Consensus Development. It was for the Consensus Development Conference on ADD. ADHD in 1998. In other words, the government paid for a group of psychiatrists to explain to the public the symptoms of ADD and ADHD, and they had a panel that was chaired by David Kupfer, and he admitted that there's really no test for it, and so they dreamed up some things that fell into that category, that if your kid did this or that, then they probably had ADD or ADHD. And Kupfer said the validity of the disorder continues to be a problem. Well, that's because there's no validity to it.
Right. But so even with that, so David Kupfer, he was the chair actually also of the new diagnostic manual,
right.
the DSM-5.
Yeah, I saw that.
So here you have it. There's no validity to it, but we're going to give powerful, mind-altering drugs to these children. But, you know, more and more and more. The sales of those drugs has, you know, tripled in, I think it was from 2007 to 2012. Yeah, it was a five-year period. It went from $3 billion annually to $9 billion annually in the sales of stimulants for ADHD. So without there being any, you know, like just what he's saying, there's no test, there's no proof. Yeah.
It's a big business. It's just a big business, that's all.
And
it doesn't matter who they destroy.
Right.
Anyway,
right.
It's a good film.
And it's, you know, it's up to the parents and teachers and, you know, primary care doctors. I mean, it's up to all of us to spread information, because what's generally out there and generally in the media is very controlled information that is controlled by those powers, by the American Psychiatric Association, by the pharmaceutical industry. And it literally, any listener right now who talks to, you know, a neighbor or somebody, literally can save somebody's life, because these drugs do destroy lives.
Absolutely.
So, yeah. Yeah.
Now, in the beginning of the film, The Hidden Enemy, there's a gentleman, a human, an individual, John Rawlings Rees, and he was the of the National Council of Mental Hygiene, who's also a co-founder of the World Health World Federation for Mental Health. So it isn't just in this country,
right.
He said that in October of 1940, he addressed the National Council for Mental Hygiene and set forth the agenda for psychiatry for the next 60 years. And he said that the psychiatrist should be given authority over every sector of our society. He said, we must aim to make it, psychiatry, permeate every educational activity in our national life, public life, politics and industry, and they should all be under psychiatry's sphere of influence, and this is back in 1940, and they said the two easiest of them are the teaching profession, where you target the children, and then the most difficult, he said, would be law and medicine. But they have done both. They've gotten into medicine and also into the law.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah, that's really chilling. You know, it's very chilling to see that it is actually an agenda and that it has been acted on over the decades, and gradually, all of those things have been met. And that's why, you know, there's really an urgency for us to wake up and, you know, and reclaim control of these things, get psychiatry out of there. But
sure.
That's very chilling. It's a chilling quote about that agenda. And then especially when, you know, you realize, what did you say the year was, 1940?
Yes, 40 October
something?
Of 1940. Uh-huh.
Yeah, when you look at where we are today, with psychiatry in the school system, in the educational system, you know, destroying literacy, you know, putting more and more kids on drugs, you know, a million children now under five. There's from 18 and under, it's 9 million in the U.S. only. So, you know, we've got a whole generation of kids just being drugged. 20% of high school boys being diagnosed with ADHD. You see in the court system, you see in the military now with, and then the destruction, the ripple effect of the destruction, which is these violent shootings, you know, the school shootings and now this, the Fort Hood shooting. This is the consequence of that agenda of getting such permeation in our culture.
Sure.
Yeah.
Wow. Now, Rees was also a member of the Tavistock Institute of Medical Psychology. And so, I mean, that's kind of interesting. Very interesting that he was with Tavistock.
Yeah. What are you thinking about that? Did you have...
The Tavistock, in 1941, a group of psychiatrists at the Tavistock Clinic saw that the right questions were asked in Parliament as a way to try to introduce drugs into British society, So it's not just here. Definitely,
yeah.
It is here, but it's a worldwide kind of a thing. And funding for the actual Tavistock Institute came from the Rockefeller Foundation.
Oh, yeah.
So
well,
it's
you know,
just...
This is a world thing. I'll give you another quote. This is from Brock Chisholm.
Yes.
Brock Chisholm was a psychiatrist and a co-founder of the World Federation of Mental Health. And he says, this is part of a quote from him, to achieve world government, it is necessary to remove from the minds of men their individualism, loyalty to family traditions, national patriotism, and religious dogmas.
Yeah.
So this is part of that agenda and part of that whole kind of larger issue you're bringing in. But it's, you know, it's a... using psychiatry, which, you know, has been used politically since it, you know, came into being, but using psychiatry to
destroy mankind.
Suppress and disable people. And, again, that's why it's so scary how much infiltration psychiatry has gotten in the military, because that's our military.
Right.
You know.
Well, in every institution, I mean, it's just amazing. But the kids, I mean, I just feel so bad for the children, and I just parents need to wake up, darn it, and recognize what they're doing, because they have the right to say no, but they don't recognize that they do. They
oh, that's right.
They have to go along with their
doctor. Yeah, they don't. They have rights. They absolutely do not have to. And if they're being pressured by a school district or a doctor to put their kid on a psychiatric drug, they need to contact CCHR, because we have help for that kind of thing. But nobody, and not even a soldier, does not have to take a psychiatric drug. They may be ordered to go see the psychiatrist. But this is also on the website, the information for them. They do not have to take a drug. So, but they don't know that. And parents get pressured, and foster parents actually get pressured. There are foster parents who are told if they don't give the kid the psychiatric drug, the child will be taken from them. Parents have had their children taken because of these school screenings where the kid gets screened and then told to be on a psych drug. There have been cases that CCHR has helped fight and won, where children have been taken away from the parent. The state and the school, the state took the child away from the parent because they didn't put him on a psychiatric drug.
Oh, my gosh.
So,
awful.
Yeah.
Terrible.
Yeah.
Terrible.
They're phenomenal abuses, you know, human rights abuses, and just intrusion into kind of the sanctity of the family, the home, parental rights. You know, psychiatry has gotten a lot of power. This case going on in the news right now, this Justina Pelletier.
Pelletier,
Boston.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. She was made a ward of the state. You know, despite her parents' anguish and other people and her other doctors who had been treating her, who knew her case, she's been locked in a psychiatric unit at Boston Hospital, Children's Hospital, I guess, for over a year now. And because of a psychiatrist said her illness was actually a mental disorder. This mitochondrial disorder she was being treated for, and she's, you know, wasting away.
Terrible.
She's not getting medical treatment anymore. But the power of a psychiatric opinion. Again, no science. Somatoform disorder that she was diagnosed with is a made up disorder. It's in the DSM. It's a made up disorder. On the power of that psychiatrist against her medical doctors, that know her and been treating her, that was the power that got her made a ward of the state.
Okay, we've run out of time. Unbelievably.
Yeah.
Thank you so much, Dr. Lagerman, for being on the program. It's been wonderful information, and I hope that people will share it with everyone that they know and that they will visit cchr.org or cchrint.org and your website, drlagerman.com. So thank you so much for being on the program today, and we'll talk to you next week at a new time, new day. Take care.
Thank you.
Thank you.